So, yeah, I got a bear.
Just to be clear, that was beer and not bear, right?
I'm talking about the liquid, not the animal.
Okay, good. I have wine. I realize that you're the one who needs the, well, needs is a strong word. You're the one who would like the beer to relax into your second language. I was looking for an excuse, so it's fine.
So welcome to this brand new podcast, Small Differences. This is episode one.
It's real. We had a pilot. This is the thing. I'm quite nervous.
You shouldn't be.
You say that. Our colleagues are listening. I know because they downloaded the pilot.
Let's jump right into stats because that's what people are tuning in for. We have the first episode, or the nil episode, has been downloaded 49 times.
Hey, that's not bad.
It's a good metric
Yeah.
for a show that hasn't been actually released yet.
Yeah, it's cool. We don't even have a marketing budget. It's amazing.
And well, I am Knut,
I'm Chris. Hello.
and this is perhaps the worst intro ever.
It is. We should explain who we are, maybe, again. Do we have to do that every time?
I don't think so.
Okay.
Just this once, again, I
Okay.
guess.
Do you want to start?
Explaining who I am. Well, that's sort of the quest, isn't it? To sort of discover who you are through podcasting. That's why people do it, I guess. But to just give you some pointers, well, I am a interaction designer and perhaps a developer or what have you, in a small or middle-sized UX firm called NetLife Research.
For anyone who doesn't know what UX is,
User experience, I think. I ha
yep,
actually
that'll
had
do.
to think a little.
Cool.
And you are?
I'm also an interaction designer, but we're coming at it from slightly different angles. I also work for NetLife, which is how we know each other.
So yeah, we covered all the awkward pauses and weird dynamics in the pilot. So let's not do that now.
We should not do that. You're right. We
So
should start. We should tell people that we have a website.
yeah, where can people find the website if they are so inclined?
That's a great question. Guess what? I closed that tab. This might be on you. Yeah. Well, we recover our website that we're extremely proud of, and I've forgotten what the name of it is. Only because it's on a platform I don't know. Yeah. Okay. So you can go to. I don't think you even need to put the triple W in, but I think you probably can if you want to. Small differences dot fireside dot FM. It's F for Foxtrot and M for Mango. I can't think of what the phonetic alphabet for M is. And if you go there, you will find that we have a pilot episode to be downloaded and a very small amount of information about the show.
And I think the reason there aren't much information about the show is because there aren't much information about the show yet.
Yeah, that seems fair.
But hopefully, if we keep the schedule, there will be soon, in a couple of weeks.
Did I mention the pressure?
Yeah, you did.
Yeah, okay,
And
it's
I'm not
fine.
doing a good job of sort of eliminating it.
It's cool. It's cool. I'll take it in hand. It's that's my responsibility. I'm apparently a grown up now, so or at least an adult. So, yeah.
Let's break the fifth wall and sort of state that we have a plan or like a script of some sorts. Not that this is scripted, that would be a horrible script, but yeah, we have some key words and stuff like that. And I can see that the next bullet item, because we love bullets, is yes and. And I guess that's a play on the theater sports or something.
Yes, it is. So I listened to the pilot episode because I wanted to get feedback on what it was actually like outside of the experience of doing it. And my major takeaway was that I wasn't a very good improvisational partner in crime, if you like, because you were left to fill a lot of the spaces. And I thought about this a little bit more. I really like having conversations with people, so I didn't think it was a problem with conversation as such. But I came to the conclusion that it was either that I was kind of stuck in you were interviewing me mode, which is like super common, I guess, in podcast land, but also a thing that sometimes people do is like, you know, they want to talk to you about what you do for a living. Not you personally, but one generally. And the other thing was that when I we had this conversation in the pilot about how you're an experienced podcaster and I'm a first-time podcaster, actually. Thanks for having me on the show. Normally when I interview people in the context of user research, we're both looking at a third thing, and that's the screen. We're both having a conversation about a third thing that's like a product or a service or a website or whatever. And we don't have that here. So there's nothing to draw focus. I actually have to open my mouth.
Yes, and I can relate to that because, well, I'm a professional podcaster, as I sort of jokingly said, but I have mostly been in the interviewer role, not saying that much actually, just leaving it to the guest to fill the gaps. So this is a good setup.
It needs to be a little bit spontaneous. There needs to be the possibility that stuff could go wrong.
Yeah.
It's a performance. I totally get that. And like the best performance is about synthesis. Like it's not a script. Right?
Yeah. And practice. And doing it. Just doing it all the time, I guess.
Cool.
So, all right. So we're almost done with the meta stuff before we dive into the real stuff.
Yeah, the last point on the list I put there as well, but I put it there because you shared a link earlier today, which was Patti Smith talking about performing for Bob Dylan when he was awarded the, I'm going to get this wrong in a minute, Nobel Prize for Literature. That is right?
That's correct.
And she was fine about it until she got up to perform and then she wasn't. And she freaked out a little bit. And it affected her performance, but not in a way that was necessarily bad. It probably just made it more real and honest. But I was thinking about that in the context of having immense potential to screw up, which pretty much defines my entire life at the moment, but up to and including this podcast. So I thought that would be a useful reference point because she comes back from it and she realizes it's probably okay. So yeah, we'll put the link in the show notes.
I like the fact that you compare our podcast to the ceremony of the Nobel Prize.
I know, right? Expectations are very high. No, it was purely a moment of recognizing that someone else was having a brief moment of being an extremely fallible human being, and I can relate to that at the moment. So,
and it's kind of comforting when it's like one of the coolest ladies in rock.
Right,
she's like 70 or something.
Yes.
And she still can be nervous about performing.
Yeah.
That's kind of sort of comforting and not.
Yeah. We should get on with the show.
Yeah, we should. The working title is First Impressions. And for those of you that have listened to the pilot episode, you know that Chris has Brexited from the UK to Norway, and that is mostly what this show will be about.
It's the thinly veiled sort of big theme, anyway. Let's see how well it stands up.
And I asked you a bit about this last time, but I was curious about sort of what was your first impressions of coming to Norway and. And all the weird stuff, of course, and the surprising stuff, and so on. And I believe also you have some questions for me, because I'm now the ambassador of all Norwegian, which is terrifying, but I will try my best.
It's appreciated. I should probably start with something which isn't even on the list, which is that my first visit to Norway was actually when I was about 11 years old. And I came with my parents and we did a house exchange with some people in Trondheim. And in addition to staying in Trondheim for 2 weeks in their house, well, they stayed in our house in the UK, They we travelled around a little bit. We stayed in some youth hostels. We went to Hamar and Lillehammer, and we took a trip around the coast, the whole south coast of Norway. So my first impression of Norway, other than enormous sort of geographical beauty, was possibly the buffet breakfast.
And what sort of discoveries did you make there?
Skimmed milk, if you can believe that.
Huh.
It was not a thing that we had had before, like fat-free milk. Pause for appreciation of Norwegian dairy products.
Yes, yeah, so I grew up with three types of milk. Yeah. We had the skimmed milk, the what we would call the whole milk, and the thing in between, half and a half, perhaps.
Semi-skimmed would be the word in the UK, but
okay.
I think some people just use half fat.
And you could almost sort of predict how people, the sort of person from the milk they were drinking.
Okay, you have to unpack that. Say more.
This is just sort of loose thoughts I just remembered, but I guess those who drank the whole milk, they were kind of, it was kind of the working people's milk, the farmers and sort of real people. And then you had sort of the urbanized people who drank the reduced fat milk. And then you have the posh people who did the skimmed milk.
Interesting. Yeah. This is the second time today that something has come up that implies there's this sort of class structure in Norway. And this is making me a little bit uncomfortable because the whole premise of Scandinavia is that it's extremely flat as a society and very, very egalitarian.
I should perhaps disclaim that I will commit broad generalizations that people perhaps won't agree with, but hey, we are doing a podcast. And and for the class structure, well, if the class structure sort of, if milk is the differing factor, I guess it's pretty egalitarian.
Egalitarian. Yeah, I'm sorry.
I think perhaps we should have a section last where I practice on some of these words I tend
okay.
to stumble on.
Okay, I'm adding this to the list of things that are hard to say. Yeah. Okay.
This will be good for me. All right. But yeah. But not to make this sort of a class on sociology, but I don't think we have like a stratified society as you have in the UK or historically have had there. But that's sort of also because we aren't that many people to be sort of stratified.
Right. There would be like three people in each layer.
Something like that.
Yeah. Okay. It's interesting. The other conversation I had today was someone who used the phrase working class about themselves, and I was really surprised to hear that.
Yeah, but it was a thing, especially in the 70s, I think, when you have sort of the socialist movement that people would sort of identify as working class. So you had academics who would sort of quit their university positions to take up like more manual work. But it was kind of sort of a facade, right? To sort of...
Were they just slumming it? Like, they could go back to their academic job any time, right?
Yeah, sort
of. Which I'm going to guess had more security and was better paid.
Yeah, at the time, I guess, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, okay, that's a whole other show. Let's not go down into the whole academic thing again.
If you were working in a university in the 70s, you were pretty set.
Yeah.
Yeah, it was a different time.
I'll say.
How do you sort of notice... the perhaps lack of, how is it in the UK now? Do you still have it? Is it still
apparent?
Wait,
we're talking about dairy products or are we talking about the class structure?
Yes, and?
Yeah, it's really complicated. I've kind of put that's on the list, actually. I've put it a little bit further down, because I think that is probably derailing us enormously from the ostensible topic of today's podcast. But yes, it still remains. It's complicated. I was going to bring up academics in that exact context, actually. So I can give you like a little teaser for that conversation now, if you like, and then we can park that and get on with it.
Yeah, especially if you have sort of felt it.
Yeah, so I'll give you an example. So I guess people are used to watching things like Downton Abbey and stuff, and obviously we've moved on a little bit since there. But we, it's possible to have, there are basically 1,000 flavors of middle class, and they're surprisingly distinct. So this is your whole idea, the whole kind of narcissism of small differences thing, right? Is that like to the outsider, superficially, these people would all be the same, but actually, if you look at them very carefully, one of the parents in one family is an academic, and they wear a kind of tweedy jacket, and they have leather elbow patches and stuff like that, and their kids go to the state school, comprehensive school, and then you look at someone else who ostensibly is an academic, and they wear a tweed jacket with leather elbow patches, and their kids are in private school. And that makes all the difference in the world, if not to the parents, then to the kids. But it's like a whole other thing.
Yeah, and in Norway, everybody goes to public school, pretty much.
That's great.
But have you sort of had any experiences after you moved here, which sort of break with expectations or?
Well, someone using the word working class was like a, that was a surprise. I think generally when you when I see people here, and admittedly I've spent the most time in Oslo of anywhere in Norway, but when I see people here, they look pretty healthy by comparison. And in the UK and other countries I've been to, including Finland actually, you could tell from people's physical appearance the extent to which they were healthy and wealthy. And I don't see that disparity quite so much, but I probably need to get out of Oslo to really bottom that one out.
What about the workplace?
What about it?
I don't know how it was like in the UK, but did sort of the social classes have sort of an impact in the workplace or?
Almost not at all. This is I'm not a reliable witness here, because I have acquired way too much education in my life to be a useful member of society, and that tends to throw you together with other people who have spent a long time in formal education as well. So it's not necessarily very typical. It just means that you end up doing the types of jobs like we'll talk later about the fact that we've both worked in academia. So I've done that. And I've worked as a software consultant, and both of those tend to throw you together with people who are at the very least financially comfortable, and who are sort of educated, strong users of technology for the most part, blah blah. So, I'm not out of my comfort zone in our workplace. Our workplace is it's very very friendly and not inconsistent with the kinds of people that I would have worked with before. Except obviously because they're listening, some of them. They're much cooler. So now that we've dispensed with the small issue of class strata and so on in post 1970s Norway and the UK by way of academia, we should probably get back to this whole topic, right?
Yeah, and I suspect that your Norwegian introductory course has been too effective because you start with talking about the weather, which is perhaps the topic of conversation in Norway. It is said that we love to talk about the weather and the climate.
The same is actually true in the UK. It's a preoccupation, although I think, and now you can tell me if this is the case here, in the UK, it's often just used as a topic of conversation, not that people care about necessarily, but because they can't think of anything to say to the other person because they don't know each other well. It's just something to say. Does that happen here?
Yeah, we have that as well, but it's also a conversation that I suspect people generally like and are interested in.
I think that's because maybe you have much more weather here.
What do you mean by much more weather? Have you sort of experienced this?
I've experienced a lot of weather in a frighteningly short span of time. I'll give you one example. There was a day in August when it was nice, it was kind of most days it would be like 19, 20 degrees and outside and mostly sunny. And one day I went for a run with my husband, and it was fine when we set out, and then it got less fine, and then it started to drizzle a little bit, and that was okay. It's fine if it rains when you're running. Sometimes it's quite nice in the summer. And then it rained some more, and then it rained some more. And by the time we got back to the apartment, we had to ford a zebra crossing. I'm not kidding. There at the bottom of the hill where we were staying at the time, there was about 8 to 10 centimeters of water shifting sideways down the road, very, very fast, continually.
And this is in Oslo, so you can imagine how my life is like. For context, I'm at the west shore of Norway in Bergen, which is known for to be the city where it rains the most in
I
Norway.
think you should point out that some of that precipitation actually falls as snow in the winter, right?
Well, it did before, but not in the later years. It's mostly just rain, variances of rain.
Yeah. Have you seen the European Sunshine Map?
If I have sort of repressed it.
Okay, that's going in the show notes. That is a thing of beauty, and it's one of the reasons that I thought Oslo would be okay for my husband, who does not like it when it rains all the time.
But there's also saying in Norway that if you're not happy with the weather, just wait 5 minutes.
That's funny because we have exactly the same phrase in the central belt of Scotland, where the weather is extremely volatile. And even though Glasgow and Edinburgh are about 45 miles apart, so that's about 65 kilometres, maybe a bit more. And they're completely different in weather a lot of the time, and it changes constantly. There you go. So, like, really, there's no difference.
We can cross that off the list. Should we have a list? Supposed differences and sort of those we can discard.
Okay, I found the European sunshine. No, wait, that's the global sunshine map. I'm sorry. I'll just leave that tab open. I'll come back to that after. We'll fill that in.
It's really a touchy topic because my summer was 2 months of continuous rain.
Where?
Here in Bergen.
Oh.
So I had a weekend in May where I got to paint the house, and I think we were in September before we had sun again. That was really, really shitty,
Yeah.
even
Man.
for our standards.
Life is hard in this country.
So therefore, it's apt that what you have written here is, why does the sun in summer feel so much more intense? I wouldn't know.
That just hurts, doesn't it? I've just twisted the knife. I'm so sorry. When it is sunny there, it's pretty sunny, right? Like the sun is intense.
Yeah, I guess I haven't really thought about it like that because, but that is sort of in lack of comparison, I think.
Okay. Moving from the UK, the sun feels extraordinarily intense in summer, which I think is another thing people from the UK mostly expect because we're further north, obviously, in Norway, and I think everyone thinks it will just be a bit cold. But actually, the sun is terrifying. It's this blinding thing in the sky, and it's very, very hot. And as a at least half British person, I turn red in the sun. Why is it the Norwegian people tan? They're blonde. A lot of them are blonde, but they still tan. How is that fair?
That's a dangerous territory, I guess, because my only theory is this is from the 40s. But I guess it's something to do with the gene pool, or I don't know.
Yeah.
Actually, my doctor told me that we have a vitamin D deficiency in Norway. People get too, they don't get enough sun, actually.
Yeah. There is a whole thing that we should go down another time about blue eyes and blonde hair and dairy products. I'm not well prepared enough to talk about that today, but have you come across this before? Like an evolutionary theory?
Yeah, I have.
Do you want to talk about it?
Sure. Yeah, we can. We have to sort of do something about Godwin's law, because it's almost impossible to talk about Scandinavian people and blonde hair and blue eyes without thinking about the Third Reich.
We can just sort of skip over that. You just kind of briefly name-checked it, so let's just, you know, acknowledge that and move on. I'm not trying to make any claims of superiority here. It was really the kind of evolutionary biology thing that led to people having blue eyes as a reaction, in part, right, to and not being lactose intolerant as a reaction to the long dark nights or something. Mm.
We have to do some research.
Yeah, this is really half-assed. Like... Sorry.
No, it's okay. Yes, and but also. About the intense sun, it's a sort of a given for me, but perhaps people don't know this, or perhaps they do. Being so far north, we have really long... In the summer, it's really long days, right? Because the sun doesn't go down.
Right.
In parts of July.
It's amazing.
Which can be, yeah, it's amazing. And but if you are a fan of sleeping in the dark, I guess you have to invest in some real curtains. But yeah,
that's the thing I remember actually from when we were here when I was a kid. Is that it would be 11 o'clock at night, and it would be time that I was supposed to go to bed, and my parents could not get me to go to bed because it was still light, and I wanted to run around.
But there's a flip side, and we are in the flip side now.
We are. We're like a week away from the kind of the nadir of the whole annual cycle.
So now we have really mostly dark days.
Yeah. Can you say anything about what time the sun gets up and goes down in Bergen at the moment?
No.
Okay. I can tell you in Oslo, I think it's about, I think the sun rises at like 9:15 or something, and then it sets at maybe 2:30 or so. I can't remember exactly. It's a short day.
And it's really weird to be in, like, in the north of the country, like in around Tromsø, where the sun never comes up. So it's just dark for weeks.
Yeah.
It's really weird.
Yeah. I sort of tempted to skip over this list a little bit and ask about the alcohol-free beer at this point.
Yeah, because this is weird to you.
No, well, it is and it isn't. So, full disclosure, I love drinking alcohol-free beer because I really enjoy beer, but I'm rubbish at drinking. So, when we got here and there were, like, comfortably in every single local shop at least kind of six kinds of alcohol-free beer, I was so happy. But I wondered if I was the only person drinking it.
If there are six variations of alcohol-free beer, I think there are a market for it.
I guess. I can't argue with that.
It's a new thing, because up until a couple of years ago, we had, like, I guess two. And if you went out, they would have one kind of alcohol-free beer, just because they sort of had to. But then, I don't know where it came from, probably Portland, but we got all these microbreweries popping up, and a newfound interest in beer.
Why did people go straight for the alcohol-free, though? Like, what was so compelling about that?
Well, they don't be... But I suspect that people got to actually appreciate beer and good beer. And not the animal. I have to work on that. And then you get sort of the... Because we have rather strict traffic laws. So it's kind of, I don't think I misrepresent it now, but I think it's kind of a common ethos that if you have had alcohol, you don't drive at all.
Right.
Even if you just had a little.
That's very sensible. That's a word I'm going to be using a lot on this podcast, but that's very sensible.
Yeah, it is. But since people appreciate the taste now, they want a wider selection, I guess. There is a market now. Yeah, it's great.
It's really nice. I really sympathise with the you go out and there's one kind thing. Unfortunately, in the UK, it's almost always Beck's Blue, which is disgusting.
So what's your favourite alcohol-free beer?
I really like the German Klausthaler, actually. That's pretty nice.
Because that's the one beer we have.
I'm not saying I don't like others either, but I enjoyed that. There's a couple of different kinds, I think. I quite like the wheat beer version of that. But yeah, I'm trying. We're just working our way through them systematically, basically.
I guess my favorite is the German Erdinger.
Oh, I like that too. Yeah. I haven't seen that here.
And just for effect, the Norwegian ass beer.
Yep.
Actually, ass uten, which is without.
Without your arse.
Yeah, something like that.
Yeah.
And on that note, beer has become a new large thing. In Norway.
What do people drink before?
I think they tended to drink more the stronger stuff.
Okay, spirits. Aquavit, or is that a stereotype?
But, yeah. I think we almost have a microbrewery in every little place now.
Wow.
It's a thing.
Yeah.
And now cider is a new thing people are doing. Apple cider.
Okay. That hasn't been around already? Or it's just coming around again, but hipster?
Well, we have had both beer and cider because we used to be a country of farming and fishing. And we have these valleys, apple valleys, which produce cider apples, but it's kind of a new hipster thing, I guess.
Mm.
They got labels. Yeah.
The hipsters or the ciders?
Both.
Yeah.
The hipster who makes the ciders.
Yeah.
We should be sponsored by Lovløs, the cider which your boss is part of making.
Is that right?
Yeah, Jostein.
I didn't know that.
One of your bosses. Okay. Bossai? Yeah.
Bossies? Yeah, not sure.
Yeah, so I guess alcohol can be a recurring topic in this podcast.
It seems a little bit likely.
Because you being from Scotland, we have to sort of touch up on the whiskey thing. Because you, of course, are endless repository of whiskey knowledge, being from Scotland.
Oh boy, you're going to be so disappointed. I do have whiskey. There are actually two bottles of whiskey in this house. In fact, we can skate neatly to the idea of the duty-free shop, in fact, because I got some of this whiskey travelling back and forth between the UK and Norway while I was commuting over the summer. And so it seemed smart, given the very high taxes on alcohol here, to pick some up on my way through. I learned very quickly that you do not buy whiskey at the Oslo end of the journey. You buy the whiskey at the London end of the journey.
Yeah, that seems sensible.
But the wine, you can do either. It's basically the same price.
Mm. Yeah, so the duty-free shop, that's a sort of a touchy topic.
Okay. Why is it touchy? Who's it touchy with? With you or with people generally?
With people like me, I guess, because I find it kind of Okay, let's do it. I find it kind of commonly.
You went there.
I went there.
Oh, dude. Okay. It's okay. We can pull it back. Right. Can I, for some context for people who don't have this context, in the UK, when you fly into the UK, there is always a duty-free shop for those who have flown in from out of the UK or out of the EU, I guess. And it's the same stuff in pretty much every UK airport. It's very tedious. There's some Toblerones. There's some whiskey and rubbish whiskey and awful vodka and, you know, some things that are just unimaginative. And no, I've never, ever in my life in the UK seen someone buy something on their way through duty-free having got off the plane already, so at their destination airport. Cut to Oslo, Gardermoen Airport, where, and maybe you'd like to describe this because you seem kind of exercised about it.
If you come from abroad, there it's sort of you have to sort of pass the duty free shop. So they got their service design in place. so you have to sort of pass it, and it's sort of obligatory to you have to buy something, and you have to buy all that you can buy within the limits of the law.
Why is that?
I think because people kid themselves that they are getting a good deal, which I guess they are, if you compare the prices to what we have in the wine monopoly, which is another topic, I guess.
I'm putting it on the list.
But it comes off like sheep purge mentality to me.
Okay.
Sort of mindlessly just buying alcohol for the sake of it, just because you can, and it's allegedly cheap. And when I say commonly, I don't mean that in sort of the economic sense, but in sort of that's the important thing to get cheap alcohol. So yeah, that's me.
Fair enough. I'm just thinking that the amount, because I commuted a little bit over the summer, the amount of wine that I got in my travels to and fro will probably do us for 2 years. We are not huge drinkers.
Yet. Just wait for the summer. I saw the thing about the summer. Okay. It's a holiday soon.
It is.
Are you going to stay in Norway for Christmas or what have you?
We are. First Norwegian Christmas. Very exciting. I say that I have made precisely zero preparations for anything, but I'm looking forward to it. How about you?
Well, I'm doing also the Norwegian Christmas or Jule.
Which involves what?
Mostly eating, and there are of course gifts, but as you get older, it's mostly about the food.
I agree.
What are you having?
We haven't decided yet. This has been the topic of some debate. It's just two of us, so we are very free to have whatever. Highly likely to feature meat.
Right.
Have not decided beyond that.
Well, I'm having pinnekjøtt, which is sheep rib, I think.
Can you say a little bit about the... I saw I was on the high street in Oslo, and there was a shop where they were selling sweaters that said Team Ribbe and Team Pinnekjøtt. So can you explain what this rivalry is?
It's yet another example of the narcissism of small differences, I guess. But in Norway, you have three very sort of possible Christmas dinners. And one of them is the rib of a sheep, which is called pinnekjøtt in Norwegian. stick meat, if you want to translate it directly, and you have pig's rib, and you
that's
have
the ribbe.
Yes.
Yeah.
And you have cod, which is most it's more usual in sort of the north. We have another one, lutefisk.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah, which is I don't know if it's a verb, but lied cod or cod in
lie, I think. Yeah. So what happens to the fish?
Well, you put fish in lye and it becomes sort of jelly-ish.
Is it nice? I never had it.
It's okay. it's got bacon, so you had that's going for it.
Yeah.
It's what not as good as sort of just regular cod, but yeah.
It's actually cod.
Yeah.
Cod and bacon is a good combination. I'm told the texture is a little weird.
Well, I think people overplay that.
Yeah.
To be honest. It's sort of a thing. But yeah, team ribbe, team pinnekjøtt. It's like team sheep versus team swine or team pig, which sounds awesome. But... it's most usual to eat sheep in the west of the country where I live, right? And in your part of the country, it is more usual to eat the pig version.
Mm.
And this east side, west side dynamic, you will find that a lot, I think.
Yeah. A thing I want to talk about maybe next time is... what it's like to grow up away from the capital city.
Hmm.
So we'll come back to that.
That's good, because I have to think about that.
Okay.
Hmm. Hmm. But you have tried both, right?
That's a good question. We've had the pinnekjøtt a couple of times at work and at the julebord, actually. I'm not sure I've had the ribbe, unless it was served at the julebord. That I might have had a couple of glasses of wine at that point, so again, not the most reliable of witnesses.
I think, to be honest, and I could be put away for saying this, being on Team Ribbe, Team Pinnekjøtt, but I think perhaps I like a well-done, not as in overcooked, but... A ribbe done well is actually more interesting.
Please don't write in.
It got
Please don't write in.
it got more nuance to it.
Okay. But,
that's just my opinion.
We're also going to come back to Norwegian use of the syllable mm. But that's another episode, I feel. I want to say one more thing about food, if I may. And I mentioned pick and mix to you, and you were, I think, perplexed.
I was, and I think I just realized what you mean.
Okay, tell me what you think I mean.
Is this the candy?
It is.
Ah. Right.
So what's it called here?
The Norwegian term would be smågodt.
Which means?
Little candy, or something like that.
Small goodies, I think, would be the... So, yeah. In Sweden, it's actually called godis, and it's very like the UK goodies, which means, I don't know, anything kind of small and nice.
Mm.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's everywhere.
It is.
which is... Stop being a surprise to me, because we spent a little bit of time in Sweden. So... I kind of got to understand that that was just a thing that they do there, but it's also a thing that they do here, and I was wondering if you knew anything about why, because it's not... So what I think of as pick and mix is where you can go and you can take a little paper bag and you get a little plastic shovel and you can put in whatever you want from the different kinds of candy, and then they weigh it and you pay for it. And it's in every single, pretty much every single corner shop, supermarket, moth boutique, basically.
Yeah, and the bags that sort of are placed in front of the stack, they are becoming larger and larger.
Really?
Which is interesting.
Are the Norwegians becoming larger and larger?
Well, I'm not sure about the public health statistics, but I think it evens out with the obsessive training and running and hiking activities.
You're right.
But I guess children are a bit fatter now than before.
Okay.
Not in the Roald Dahl sense, but yeah, I think we weigh a little more now. But pick and mix, that was sort of how you did it before, with everything, including candy.
Oh, you mean back in the old days when you would go to your grocery store and they would go to the sack, or you would go to the sack and put in like a kilogram of flour.
Exactly, and that is not that long ago.
Mm. When did that stop?
I think the first supermarket in Norway they opened like in the late 70s.
That's surprisingly recent.
Yeah, it is. So, yeah. So I can sort of remember places when I was a child that sort of had this. You had this desk and you have to say to the person what you wanted. At least in small places around in Norway. So I think perhaps it's just a continuation of that mode of buying candy. But it, when you see, when you look at the commercial side of it, it makes sense because, yeah, you can sell it. I think the margins are good.
Yeah. Why candy, though? Like, if you go to the UK, people might buy a chocolate bar, and they're cheaper to buy there. So I think people perhaps eat more of that kind of thing. But I'm not sure that adults would eat very much candy. So what is it about candy here?
I'm not sure, but I would guess a mix of availability and the fact that this is sugar.
Always good. Very bad, but always good.
Yeah, something like that.
The thing I've put in the notes here is about this Swedish study that happened in the 60s, which I'm now going to recall all wrong. Do you know anything about this?
No, I don't.
So I think originally, and I'm remembering this from my Swedish classes, I don't know about Norway, candy was available kind of quite freely, and then they figured out that it was really bad for people's teeth. And so they conducted a study, I think, in some Swedish institution, and I mean institution in the worst way, like the people there were not there voluntarily, and they chose to feed some people candy every day and other people only candy once a week on a Saturday. And the people who only had candy once a week, I guess it was the same amount, but I don't really know, more or less kept their teeth, and the people who had it every day lost all their teeth.
Interesting.
And in Sweden, one of the words, there are about five words for candy in Sweden, but one of them is lördagsgodis.
Yeah, because I grew up with lördagsgodis.
Mm.
Only candy at Saturdays.
Yeah. So, sorry, lördag is Saturday for people listening who are not Norwegian speakers.
So we had candy just at Saturdays to barneteve or the half hour when we had children's television.
Half an hour?
Yeah.
That's very constrained, very confined. Is that so that the rest of the time you could go outdoors like a healthy child?
Something like that.
Okay, we're going to talk about that next time.
So every day at 6, there were barneteve, children's television. And it was, and Saturdays was a special day because At 5 you had the children's programming on the radio, and then at 6 you had the on television, and they were kind of this show in tended to sort of not teenagers, but just before teenagers, that went after the children television thing at Saturdays, and then you had the Lørdagsgodt, the goodies, and this bag of this sort of pre-picked bag of pick and mix that was I think I it was named Lørdagsgodt. So they got the branding all in place.
Wow.
And this was in the 80s and 90s.
I'm just thinking that recent history is almost unimaginable to kids who are now kids.
Yeah.
For so many reasons, like the idea of scheduled broadcast TV and the idea of radio, I guess internet radio is a thing, I guess. You know, all of that. But also the idea that you might only have like a half an hour or an hour of programming. The world has changed a lot.
Yeah, I feel old now.
And I think actually that during the 80s, there was a lot more choice from the UK. Something else that I'd like to come back to, maybe in the future, which is to talk about the influence of UK kids' TV here.
In Norway, if you didn't have cable, you had one channel.
You guys had cable in the 80s?
Yeah, in urban environments or satellites, I think.
Wow, that seems very modern. Also,
I think Oslo had, at least in the 90s, but if you didn't have either a satellite dish or cable, you had two channels in the 90s to choose from.
Wow, such riches. I shouldn't mock you. I think we got our fourth channel in the UK in, might have been 84, and that really isn't that far ahead. Do you want to knock this on the head, or do you want to carry on a bit?
Let's carry on.
All right. Candy follow-up. Melkesjokolade.
Ah, melkesjokolade, the milk chocolate.
Yeah.
The infamous milk chocolate, or...
Infamous.
Infamous.
Say infamous, why it's infamous. Infamous.
Because it is the best chocolate
in the world.
There is, yeah.
What's special about it?
It actually is made from milk.
And unlike milk chocolate in other places, or
here is where my national pride comes in. The makes me biased, I guess.
That's okay. There's nothing wrong with opinion. This is an opinion piece. It's fine.
Is it more fatty or
higher dairy solids, maybe, or something, or milk solids, or something like that?
Yeah, perhaps.
Okay. I noticed that a lot of Norwegian chocolate, more than anywhere I've ever been in my life, has hazelnuts in it. Why is that?
I don't know. To be honest, I hope this show will not become you asking questions that I cannot answer. We can have follow up. Yeah, you can ask the questions. I can sort of research them and give a more comprehensive explanation. But I think when it comes to chocolate, you have two things. You have tradition. So you have sort of the bars that we always have had, and people in Norway is pretty conservative about their foods, which I imagine most people are everywhere. But especially food brands. So we sort of don't diverge from we got our sort of you always buy that kind of what have you canned soup, right? You don't diverge from that brand.
Okay.
So we are pretty sort of
brand loyal.
Yeah, loyal. Right. That's a word. And also chocolate. So like the regular melkechokolade or milk chocolate, that's an institution, right? And you have something called firkløver.
I'm a big fan.
Four clover, which is the hazelnut one. That was sold or introduced to the market in 1926.
That's very specific. Are you actually working for the Firklor company, or?
No, I can internet.
How can I not hear you typing? What are you doing?
I has the internet. Yeah. So. I think the selection of, but come on, hustle. It's like nougat chocolate, right?
A little bit, but it's not that sweet. Like it's some of it's kind of praliney, but a lot of the stuff is just milk chocolate with hazelnuts in. And I was just really surprised that so much of the chocolate here has hazelnuts in. It's unusual. In the UK, you do get kind of Cadbury's and the big brands have. You can buy whole nut, which is, as you might suppose, a bar of milk chocolate with whole nuts in it, whole hazelnuts. But it's non-standard, and here it's just absolutely everywhere.
I see, but we have a fairly new chocolate that was introduced just a couple of years ago, called Walters Mandler, or the almonds of Walter. that doesn't translate well.
It certainly doesn't.
And that's sort of.
And do you think that's selling well, or?
Yeah, it's a huge success, because it got nuts, it got chocolate, and a bit of salt.
Oh, I can see why that would do well. I have to try this.
Killer combination.
Yeah, it is. Fat, sugar, salt, that's the kind of the magic triangle, right, for food.
So the first endorsement from Small Differences are the nuts of Walter. Right.
Don't write in. Unless it's to offer a sponsorship, in which case, write in.
Yeah, Freya, or Kraft Foods.
Do you want to be sponsored by Kraft? Do you, though? Heavy pause.
It depends.
Okay.
If they got the nuts. So, right.
Sorry, pause for laughter. You're on your own there for a minute. I was trying to be quiet.
That's generally not a good idea for a podcast.
It's better than breathing into the mic, I thought.
We can cut that in post.
Excellent.
But, right. Yes. So yeah, you arrived in Norway. You are doing your daily grocery shopping, and then it became Sunday.
Right, and it was not totally unexpected, but a little bit unexpected that generally the shops in Norway do not open on a Sunday. Some of them do. Not many. Some of the smaller food shops, so kind of corner stores, remain open, but most of them not. Which is interesting, because it forces you to make choices about what you're going to do with your day that don't revolve around going somewhere and buying something. And it's not that I'm a particular freak about spending all of my free time in the shops, but when you can't, you have to think a bit. You know, like, theoretically, I could use, like, an hour or two of the day to just go and do a huge grocery shop, right, on a Sunday. But not if the shops are shut. So it makes you go outside. It makes you go and go to the park or, you know, go out into nature a little bit. It's interesting. Perhaps in another episode you could say a little bit more about why this is.
Yeah, just to give a teaser, it probably has something to do with the fact that Norway were a fairly Christian country not that long ago. And piety were a thing.
Piety.
Piety or piety. Yeah, piety. Yeah. And it still has some... Yeah.
There's a long tail on that. Mm. I should be clear that in the UK there's a thing called Sunday trading laws at the moment, which intermittently people think about trying to get overturned, but which stipulates that if the store is above a certain size, and I can't remember what the size is, but the footprint of the store is above a certain size, then they can only be open some very restricted hours, which is something like 11 until 5, so 6 hours on a Sunday. Some places do close, you know, particularly smaller stores, because I think people want to take a day off. But it's very common for shops to be open, even if just reduced hours, on a Sunday.
And not just sort of grocery or supermarkets, but also other kind of shops, right?
Right, like clothing stores, you know, everything. Like everything is pretty much closed, except sort of things that you would do to improve yourself, like going to a gallery or going to a museum or things that are good for you.
Right. So actually, there are one kind of shop that doesn't need to be closed at Sundays, and that is the sort of the I think flower shop is sort of it's like the agricultural shop, right?
Can you say more about this?
Those can be open on Sundays, right? Where you buy your flowers and your garden equipment, and they also sell chocolates.
Is it the kind of place where there's a cafe as well, maybe, and you can sit down and have like a little piece of cake and a cup of tea, or?
No, not really.
Okay.
It's more like, because the rationale is that farmers had some needs, like they sort of had to have the opportunity to go out on Sundays and get what they needed for what they do.
Huh.
And this law has sort of persisted.
And are these the kind of stores that people who aren't farmers would go to on a Sunday as well?
Now it's like if you are way into gardening, you can sort of take your Sunday at the flower store.
Okay. In the UK, it would be called a garden centre.
Garden centre.
And you could go and buy like a huge sack of sort of compost to put your plants in or whatever. But almost invariably, there's also like a little cafe place where you can sit down and, you know, so that you spend more time there. I think it's to encourage you to spend more time there and maybe buy more things.
They don't have those in Norway, like the cafes.
Yeah.
That's a possibility.
You guys are, I think, dragging your heels on this whole capitalism thing. You're trying hard, but I can tell that your heart is just not in it.
Well, people like to have their coffee at home.
Okay. Do you want to open that box? Or should we save the coffee thing for the episode about food? We've spent like 90% of this episode on food already.
We could have an episode on coffee.
We could. This is actually true. I'm making a note. Yeah.
So yeah. I think actually we have to sort of perhaps think about ending this episode. Hopefully.
I think you're probably right. I think we're running a little bit long.
People at my office told me that an hour of podcast was too long. They wanted 18 minutes.
I'm just warming up here. What is going on?
Do you have the pause button? I don't know.
I guess not.
It's entirely unreasonable to me. But then again, I can listen to 3 hours with a podcast episode.
Yeah, so, as a long-form blogger, I'm extremely sympathetic.
So, as our listeners, as you, my dear listener, perhaps has discovered, we don't have that type of a structure to our episode. This isn't Radio Lab or Reply All, or it's not produced in any way. But we have a recurring segment, which is called Ukens Ord, or the Word of the Week, where Chris and I will present you a interesting, provoking word from the Norwegian vocabulary.
Do you want to go first?
I can. Yeah, sure. So my word, it's lø, lø. It's L and ø, which is like the O with a sort of a stroke through it.
And I don't know this word. What does it mean?
That is actually a new word in Norway. And this is my tabloid etymology. I think it comes from Arabic, and the Arabic word for now. And it used to mean in Norwegian slang something cool, but now it means something irritating or boring or just yeah.
The same words.
Yeah.
It's become devalued.
Yeah.
Okay.
Exactly.
Could you use it in a sentence?
Det der var skikkelig lø.
That was really lø, where, depending on, I guess, on when you said that, it yeah. would either be a good thing or a bad thing?
Yeah, stupid or, yeah, huh. not cool or something like that.
Interesting.
And yours?
So my word is perhaps less culturally interesting than that, but someone who's trying to learn Norwegian, I'm spending a lot of time thinking about the construction of Norwegian words. Norwegian words are, so Norwegian is really Germanic as a language, so it does that Germanic thing of sticking small words together to make bigger words, and then the bigger words mean something slightly different. But it's super logical. It's really delightful in that way. And the word that I've chosen is framskrivinger, which means projections. At least I hope it does. Is that right?
Yeah, it sounds right.
Yeah. And there's like a whole thing going on here where I could have said framskrivinger probably, but that's conservative bookmål, and I should probably tend more towards the way that people actually talk, right? Which is probably fram. So... I'm interested in this word because if you break it up into its constituent parts, fram means forward, skriving is the act of writing, and ur is just the plural on the end, so projections, plural, is framskrivinger. And I think it's kind of interesting that it basically means, like, forward writings. And I was also struck by that it isn't framtegninger, which you might expect, which would be forward drawings, or sketchings, I guess, but it's writing. Like, the implication is that it's actually figures and letters. The forward-going writings. That's all I got for you.
Exciting.
This is probably, to you, it's probably the most dull word in the world, but I'm currently fascinated by picking apart longer Norwegian words.
I would say it's a bit lø.
Oh. Burned. All right, you want to knock it off there while I'm in the gutter clutching my knees.
So Chris, if people don't remember where they could find all the links and episodes and the marketing materials and perhaps a new logo, where can they go?
They can go to smalldifferences.fireside.fm and they will find the episodes there. They will find a link to the only intermittently used, but I like it anyway, Twitter account, smalforskjeller, which means small differences in Norwegian. And if you go to the website, you will also find out how to spell it, because as we learned on the pilot episode, I have great difficulty spelling Norwegian words aloud with English letters. I can do it in Norwegian letters, it's just really strange to switch between them.
And if people want to follow you in the social medias?
Yeah, they can do that. I am at Finite Attention, and I am on Twitter. And you?
I am K. Melve, And you can find me. Perhaps the easiest thing is just to go to our website and click the links.
We're going to have to do a whole episode on how we pronounce letters in Norwegian.
Yeah. We can sort of make a sort of a card people can print out.
Oh, nice. I like it. Analog. Good paper.
Yeah.
Like you know, high weight per square meter paper. All right.
Yes. So next week.
What are we going to talk about next week? Growing up Norwegian.
I have to do some... I have to... So perhaps I should go to hypnosis or... I have to dig up a lot of memories, which...
There are some of them you can just leave buried. It's fine. You don't need to drag some of that in. It's okay. It's okay. I know we said this is a safe space, but it's... I mean, if you can unload, you know, you want it, that's fine, but...
Well... So my parents, when they got me, they were students. So I moved a lot when I was growing up.
Wow.
And which means that my memory of growing up is sort of spotty. but I will do my best.
Okay. I look forward.
Right. We don't have a sort of a closing ritual.
We don't.
Or a bell or a song or something like that. But I know. First, you have to thank you for listening. And we can close off with a Norwegian close off. Ha det bra.
Takk. Ha det.